Well, good afternoon, and welcome once again to the Mike Wilson Show on WWGH. And we have a good friend of the show on line right now. Fred?
Good evening. Merry Christmas to you.
Well, Merry Christmas to you, Fred.
And to all your listeners.
Yes, most certainly. And I believe we're going to be talking about Victorian-era Christmases today. Is that correct?
We are. We absolutely are. The Victorian era was a wonderful time created from the reign of Queen Victoria in England. Actually ran from 1837 to 1901. She was born in 1819 and was crowned or had her coronation in 1837, which began her reign. She passed away in 1901, and so hence the Victorian era passed away when she did. However, in America, a lot of people that collect antiques and talk about the period of the time oftentimes include clear up to the year 1910 for the Victorian era. But the official dates are 1837 and 1901. I want to start out the show with reading a poem that was written by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. And you'll recognize this poem because I'm sure that at some point in all of our lives we've sang a song that was taken from this poem. It's called Christmas Bells, and it was actually written in 1863 on Christmas Day by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow because the Civil War was raging on throughout the country. I heard the bells on Christmas Day their old familiar carols play, and wild and sweet the words repeat of peace on earth, goodwill to men, and thought how, as the day had come, the belfries of all Christendom had rolled along the unbroken song of peace on earth, goodwill to men, till ringing, singing on its way, the world revolved from night to day, a voice, a chime, a chant sublime of peace on earth, goodwill to men. Then from each black, accursed mouth, the cannon thundered in the south, and with the sound, the carols drowned of peace on earth, goodwill to men. It was as if an earthquake rent the hearthstones of a continent and made forlorn the households born of peace on earth, goodwill to men. And in despair, I bowed my head. There is no peace on earth, I said, for hate is strong and mocks the song of peace on earth, goodwill to men. Then pealed the bells more loud and deep. God is not dead, nor doth he sleep. The wrong shall fail, the right prevail, with peace on earth, goodwill to men. And that kind of fell right in the middle of the Victorian era. Now, it's hard to imagine, but at the beginning of the 19th century, Christmas was really hardly celebrated. Mm-hmm. Many businesses didn't even consider it a holiday. However, by the end of the century, by the end of the Victorian reign, it had become the biggest annual celebration and took on the form that we kind of recognize today somewhat. There was always a big Christmas dinner and usually a Christmas Eve gathering before Mass or before church. Now, the transformation really happened kind of quickly and came from all sectors of society. Victoria and her husband Albert had gathered around the Christmas tree with their children on Christmas Eve. And as I said earlier, many attribute the change to Queen Victoria because it was her marriage to the German-born Prince Albert that introduced some of the most prominent aspects of Christmas. In 1848, the Illustrated London News had published a drawing of the royal family celebrating around a decorated Christmas tree, and that was a tradition that was reminiscent of Prince Albert's childhood in Germany. So a lot of the customs actually originated in Germany. Soon every home in Britain had a tree bedecked with candles, sweets, fruit, homemade decorations, and small gifts. There's really nothing like a Victorian Christmas with its party games, delightful decorations, fragrant food and drink. So we're going to travel back in time to learn just a little bit more about these wonderful traditions and how they evolved. I want to mention before we get started that there are two places very close to us where you can actually attend a Victorian Christmas dinner. Now, I'm not sure with COVID this year whether they're taking place or not, but I know in recent years, going back at least 25 years that I'm aware of, both of these locations have had a full-blown Victorian dinner that you could, for a fee, pay and attend. One was at the Hayes Home over in Fremont. I'm sure, Mike, mm-hmm. you're familiar with the Hayes Home.
Been there several times.
A wonderful place to be, and if you've ever had an opportunity to go through the Hayes Home at any time, but especially at Christmas time, it's bedecked with all of the things that you would see in the Victorian era, because, of course, Hayes was present right in the middle of the Victorian mm-hmm. area, towards the latter part of the Victorian era. And the other place is the Wright Mansion at Lyme Village, and that's up just a little bit south of Route 4, or a little bit north of Route 4, just outside of Bellevue. The Wright Mansion was built about in the middle 1850s, right prior to the Civil War. And in the last 25, 35 years, a group of people from that area have created this place called Lyme Village, which is like a little village where they've collected houses and so forth throughout the county and preserved them, rebuilt them on location. But the Wright Mansion, three-story brick structure that was built pre-Civil War, still stands and is a wonderful part of that village. And every year, the group of volunteers there at the Wright Mansion have the same type of Victorian dinner that they have over at Fremont, the Hayes Home. These dinners are wonderful things because in a Victorian dinner, you're going to see anywhere from 8 to 14 courses. So you don't walk away empty from a Victorian dinner. We'll talk a little bit more about the dinner and what you might see at a Victorian dinner later on, but I wanted to mention those two things. So if you would happen to Google Lyme Village or the Hayes Home in Fremont, you can find out whether or not those are going on. And chances are they're sold out for this year. I know a lot of people repeat them, but you may want to put that on your calendar and think about that for a post-COVID Christmas holiday season next year.
Well, I was just checking out the Hayes Home Spiegel Grove, of course,
mm-hmm.
and they do have home holiday tours the 19th through the 20th, and the 22nd through the 23rd.
Oh, great.
But there's no mention of the meal, so I don't know if that's going on or not.
It probably has been canceled because they do have it in the dining room there at the Hayes Home, and I think it seats something like 12 or 14 people around the dining room table, but they would all be in too close a proximity to satisfy with COVID rules, and obviously you can't eat with a mask on. So.
No. I've eaten in that room, by the way.
Yeah, it's a great place. It really is, and I have too, and it's an absolute fun place. Well, let's talk a little bit about the Christmas tree. The Christmas tree obviously has been a German tradition since as early as the 17th century. Many ancient civilizations held evergreens to be a symbol of life during the long winter months and decorated these trees as a symbol of eternal life. In 1841, Prince Albert, German husband, of course, of Queen Victoria, introduced this charming custom to the royal family. And in 1850, a tinted etching of a decorated tree at Windsor Castle was published, and the Tannenbaum became a necessity for every fashionable Victorian home. It was a tradition quickly embraced by Victorian England and very soon entered the United States. Live trees were set up for the Christmas season, oftentimes decorated with lighted candles, draped with tinsel, ribbon, paper chains, cookies, and candles. Now, obviously, in the early days, and clear up until the time of Thomas Edison, they didn't have electric lights to string on those trees. So they used candles, which you have to stop and think could be very dangerous,
sure.
obviously, with a live tree, especially as the season rolled on and it started to get a little dark. And I do remember as a child going to my grandparents' home on the farm and on Christmas Eve, and standing in front of the pocket doors, waiting for my grandfather to open the doors in which we could see the tree completely lit with candles. So that's the early 50s, so my grandparents were still doing it then. But you would always see at least one or two buckets of sand nearby.
Right.
Because if you had a breakout, you needed to put that out and quickly. But they did make for an absolute gorgeous thing to look at. Let's see.
Fred, while you're looking that
yes.
up, I did check out on Lyme Village, and they have rescheduled their popular Victorian Christmas dinners for March 19th, 20th, 21st of 2021.
Oh, great. Well, there's still an opportunity.
Mm-hmm. But a little bit late, but that's good.
Won't be Christmas, but at least you'll be able to see what's going on there, if everyone's got a vaccine by then.
Yes.
Let's see, by the 1880s, the Victorian idea of Christmas was really not too commercial, having more to do with food and the exchange of handmade gifts. New York soon saw the commercial advantages of a holiday full of the exchange of gifts, so Guess what? Old Macy's department store windows were filled with wonderful dolls and toys from Germany, France, Austria, and Switzerland. Another window also boasted scenes with steam-driven movable parts. And for those of us who grew up here in Ohio and had the opportunity to go to Columbus when Lazarus was big in the 50s and 60s, their windows on High Street were always decorated with Christmas displays, especially the trains and all the moving figures and the, you know, nutcrackers and all that type of thing. They were absolutely fabulous to see. Homemade cornucopias of paper were filled with fruits and nuts and candy and popcorn, and these were oftentimes hung from the branches of the trees, both in America and in Europe or in England. Beautiful shaped cookies were also hung for treats on the Christmas tree, and often the gifts were also wrapped and hung from branches. And I don't remember what Christmas song it is, but one of the Christmas songs has one of the lines in the song says, presents hung from the tree, or presents on the tree, I think it says, rather than under the tree.
I think that's I'll Be Home for Christmas.
Could very well be, and I think there are versions now of that song where they do say presents under the tree instead of on the tree. But in the early days, they were on the tree, and oftentimes you were only going to receive one present. Unlike the multiple presents that we think we have to buy these days and give to folks, usually there was only one person or one present per person in a household. With the growing popularity of Christmas trees, manufacturers began producing glass ornaments around 1870. Also popular were molded wax figures of angels and children. Many ornaments were made of cotton wool, wrapped around an armature of either metal or wood, and trimmed with embossed paper faces. Buttons, gold paper wings, and diamond dust, which actually was powdered glass, was sprinkled on these ornaments. And if you've seen a lot of ornaments that came out of the 40s and 50s, you'll see that kind of glittery stuff on there. Obviously, I don't think it's real glass, but that was to simulate what was done back during the Victorian period. The first Christmas card was designed by a gentleman by the name of J.C. Horsley, and it was sent by a fellow by the name of Henry Cole, who decided to send his many acquaintances something different than his standard Christmas letter that he always sent out. They sold for 1 shilling apiece in Europe and a nickel here in this country, and only 1,000 copies were lithographed. It depicted the charities of clothing and feeding the poor, with the middle section depicting a well-to-do family toasting to Christmas and the year ahead. It proved to be a very popular idea. Now, in addition to Christmas cards, one of the other things that emerged from and came from Germany that became part of the Victorian culture and the Victorian heritage, which I really wish was continuing on today because I think it's a fabulous way to communicate with folks, is the postcard.
Mm-hmm.
Custom postcards were being made and sent to relatives or friends throughout your Christmas list or whatever you had at the time. And these were really popular between 1890 and 1910. As I say, they were originated in Germany. And the company that we hear about mostly in the manufacturing of cards, postcards in general, not just Christmas cards, but postcards in general, was a company by the name of Raphael Tuck & Sons. And they were out of Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a large postcard company here in the United States called International Art Publishing that produced a lot of these particular Christmas cards that were actually postcards. And they were all done with artist renditions on the front of them. And the most popular one, if you can find them today, were done by a lady by the name of Ellen Clapsaddle. She was the artist. And her figures that she would create, the people's faces and with children and that type of thing on these cards, just absolutely beautiful. I've been collecting postcards for a number of years, not just the Christmas postcards, but all the holidays. And Raphael Tuck & Sons were the most prolific in doing these cards. And if you can find Raphael Tucks today, you've made a good find, because a lot of them will include the artist renditions being done by Ellen Clapsaddle. You ever run across any of those in your travels?
That name does sound familiar.
Yeah,
I bet I have.
She was just a fabulous artist, and her work was so lifelike and the characters just kind of jumped out at you. They were so much lifelike. The exchange of presents of ancient origin symbolized good luck, prosperity, and happiness. So by giving a present or a card, you were really kind of trying to give someone good luck or happiness for the coming new year, if it were around Christmas time. Those were the wishes that you had for your friends. The Victorians began planning their presents many, many months ahead. And, of course, the most cherished were those that were handmade, needlework or something useful. People exchanged remembrances with family and with friends, and children made their gifts as well. Now, I have a book that was written in 1881, and it's on Victorian decorum, and it covers a lot of different subjects, not just Christmas time and things like that, but it covers the things that you should do if you're visiting people and that type of thing. And there's one little section in here on presents among friends that's related to Christmas, and I wanted just to read a little bit out of this book on etiquette, and these are from the Miscellaneous Rules of Etiquette on Decorum, written in 1881. Among friends, presents ought to be made of things of small value, or, if valuable, their worth should be derived from the style of the workmanship or from some accidental circumstance rather than from some inherent and solid richness. Especially never offer to a lady a gift of great cost. It is in the highest degree indelicate, and it looks as if you were desirous of placing her under an undue obligation to you and of buying her goodwill. The gifts made by ladies to gentlemen are of the most refined nature possible. They should be little articles, not purchased, but deriving a priceless value as being the offspring of their gentle skill, a little picture from their pencil or a trifle from their needle. My, has that changed a lot or what?
Yes, sir.
I kind of get a kick out of that because you're not supposed to worry about value, and that's all we worry about today, are the value of things. Let's talk a little bit about Santa. He was a mixture of many different figures from many different cultures. The Dutch had Saint Nick, England had its Father Christmas, and the Germans had Kris Kringle. Now, in ancient times, the Norse and German people told stories of the Yule Elf, who brought gifts during the solstice, the winter solstice, to those who left offerings of porridge. When Clement Moore's poem, The Night Before Christmas, became enormously possible, the jolly old elf, the jolly old elf, has adopted as the ideal Santa. Years later, Thomas Nast, have you heard that name before?
Yes, I have.
Yep, he was often did a lot of illustrations during the Victorian era.
Mm-hmm.
He was in Collier's and several other publications of the day, the New York Times and so forth. He illustrated him as a round-bellied whisker fellow in tight red leggings and a coat. And then, of course, who could forget Coca-Cola's popular advertising that changed the concept of Santa to a cheerful, full-bearded man with the now popular red suit, black boots, and a wide belt.
Mm-hmm.
Although Christ's nativity has been celebrated since the 4th century, most of the English customs we are familiar with today are as recent as the mid-19th century. Many of these ceremonies were rooted in pagan beliefs, and some of the customs, like wassailing, still survive. And, of course, wassailing, for those who do not know, is singing carols from door to door. The Protestant Reformation condemned most of these pagan customs as superstitious and banned public celebrations of Christmas. Now, the Puritans abolished all celebrations after the Civil War also. A fervor for the holiday declined even into the Georgian area. It wasn't until Prince Albert married Queen Victoria and brought many German customs with him that Christmas again started to gain its popularity that it had before the Victorian era started. One of the first signs of Christmas was the arrival of the Christmas card in the post. John Horsley designed the first Christmas card in 1846 for that Henry Cole that we talked about earlier, who was actually the chairman of the Society of the Arts. Remember, we said just 1,000 of those cards were printed that first year, and they were quite expensive. Then in 1870, postage was reduced to 0.5 cents per ounce, and cheaper color lithography was used for the printing, and that's where those postcards started coming in. Toward the latter part of the 19th century, the 1880s, 1890s. This, of course, then began the real spread of the Christmas card, and by the early 1870s, the custom had reached the United States. At first, the designs were very simple, but as technology advanced, new subjects evolved, and by the 1860s, 1870s, popular designs were Christmas trees, church bells, snowbound mail carriers, and turkey and plum puddings. And then when Ellen Clapsaddle appeared upon the scene, then we started to see a lot more of those characters, those figurines, the actual people being used on those cards. Christmas decorations sometimes appeared well before the holiday also, but many until still held those old superstitions of bad luck to erect evergreens before Christmas Eve, which one of the most favorite plants were all the midwinter berries that were being produced about that time, mistletoe, holly, and ivy.
Mm-hmm.
The red berry of the holly was believed to protect one against witchcraft. The sprig had to be carried into the house by a male, as the berry is on the male holly plant. One use for holly sprigs was to decorate the Christmas pudding. The female ivy symbolized more immortality. Mistletoe, because of its pagan origins, was not allowed in any church. Now, kissing under the mistletoe was a purely English custom, but quite quickly evolved in the United States. And only as many berries as were on the mistletoe could there be kisses.
Really?
Yeah.
I had never heard that.
So for every kiss, a berry had to be removed from the sprig.
Okay.
Yeah, so you had to be careful. You didn't want to remove all those berries too quickly.
That's
or you
true.
Wouldn't have any more kisses.
That's
left.
True.
So truly, a lot of these customs can be attributed to the Victorian innovation and coming again from Germany. By 1847, the trees at Windsor Castle were laden with presents as well as those wax candles. The tradition spread as English citizens followed the royal example. The trees and other decorations were removed on the 12th night, which is January the 6th. To do so before or after was considered bad luck. So the 12 days of Christmas ending then, if you left them up beyond that time, it was bad luck. Well, I have to remind the people around here that leave their Christmas decorations up until spring.
I was going to say, does that apply to Christmas lights?
Well, it could very well. It could very well. Now, one custom that, one of my favorite customs that came from Germany that quickly became popular with the Victorians in the United States was the custom of the pickle on the Christmas tree. Are you familiar with the custom?
Actually, I recently read about that. But
okay.
Yes.
A very fascinating custom. When the little children would come down in the morning, there would be one pickle placed on the tree. And most times, it was a glass ornament pickle. And depending upon the age of the children, determined the size of the pickle. Now, whoever found the pickle got an extra present. Because, as I said earlier, everyone only got one present.
Mm.
So when the little children would come down in the morning, they would scour the tree to find that pickle. And the one that found it first, obviously, got that extra prize. As the children got a little older, the pickle... I got this backwards. Now, I knew I was going to screw this up. As when they were smaller, the pickle was larger, and as they got older, the pickle would get smaller.
Okay, so harder to find.
To find. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. So I love that custom. When my son was small, I started finding glass pickles in various places where they made Christmas ornaments, and we did that custom clear up until I think he was about 10 or 11 years old. And it was always fun to try to plant it in there where he couldn't find it, especially when the pickle got so small that I could barely see it. But a great custom. And Christmas trees were not always live. The Victorians devised the feather tree. Are you familiar with the feather tree?
I have heard of that custom, yes.
Well, the feather trees, again, were handmade. They were generally just one single pole, and around them they would wrap feathers. And the feathers could come from any bird, mostly larger birds, turkey feathers, feathers from hawks, any kind of bird feathers, whatever they could find. And that would be decorated them with ornaments just like a regular Christmas tree would be. And you can actually find today, if you look around in some more exquisite shops and Christmas places in general that sell Christmas items, you can find imitation feather trees. I have one that I bought a number of years ago that we used to put up and put old ornaments on. And they're really kind of fun. to deal with, especially because it kind of brings back that whole, you know, Victorian Christmas type era. We've talked a little bit about the dinner. We mentioned the dinner earlier. Christmas dinner was a grand affair with the Victorians. Goose, chicken, or a joint of roast beef took center stage on the table. Turkey, while popular in America, wasn't necessarily customary fare until the late 19th century in England. And as I said earlier, Victorian dinners, especially at Christmas time, could run anywhere from 8 to 14 courses. They usually started out with soup, followed by fish, and of course when the table was set, there was always a bone dish at every plate where you would deposit your fish bones. Bread, and bread, by the way, was meant to be cut and not torn with your teeth in your mouth, followed by a number of side dishes, which could be anything from carrots to green beans to potatoes to whatever side dish you could imagine, followed by fowl or beef, followed by fruit of many different types, followed by pudding, usually bread pudding, plum pudding, or something like that, and then followed by dessert, which it could include pies, cakes, or cream, which modern-day times would be some form of ice cream. Mm-hmm. Now, after the dinner, the men would retire to the drawing room where they would have their smokes and their brandy, and the women would retire to the music room or the front parlor where they would await the men to finish and come in so they could start the celebration. Families began their Christmas Day normally with celebrating of Mass. Christmas Eve services didn't become popular here until after after the Second World War, so Mass was generally attended normally during the morning hours or possibly around 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening.
Okay.
The peal of the bells called everyone to church, and at the services, scriptural lessons were interspersed with carols, and most of the carols we sing today were written in the 19th century, although some old favorites like Silent Night and Hark the Herald Angels Sing are much, much older.
Mm-hmm.
Carols were also sung at home, and families even went door-to-door to entertain others, also going from house to house with the wassailers that we talked about earlier. And these were usually the poorer people in the parish who were looking either for donations of drink, food, or money as they invited others to drink from their wooden bowl that they carried with them. Christmas pudding made with beef, raisins, and prunes was mixed up or stirred up on Sunday, the Sunday before Advent, in order for the mixture to mature. All present in the house took turns stirring the pudding with a wooden spoon in honor of the Christ Child's wooden crib. The stirring had to be done in a clockwise direction for luck, never counterclockwise. And mince pies were another traditional dish, and they were sweeter, often made with minced meat, fruit, and spices, and they had to be eaten for the 12 days of Christmas to ensure those 12 months of good luck in the coming year.
Oh, okay.
Each one eaten had to be baked by a different person, however, so there was much sharing with friends as you went along. Now, after dinner, children pulled their crackers and everyone exchanged gifts. Do you know what pulling your cracker is?
I do know from Are You Being Served?
Okay.
I love that show.
Well, pulling a cracker. A cracker was a toy or a present when pulled from either both ends, made a cracking sound,
mm-hmm.
and it often had a joke or a small present inside. So after the children pulled their crackers, they went into the parlor where the Christmas tree was, and they started to exchange their gifts. The evening usually ended with parlor games and singing going on as well. And I was going to read one little thing out of here. If I can find it, and I can't put my hands on it now. Guess it didn't really matter. covered that. Okay. Victorians celebrated Christmas with characteristic enthusiasm and a deep respect for custom and tradition. On the high days of the calendar, Christmas was always the one which had the chief place both in England and again in America during the Victorian era, where it was celebrated in a manner so different from what was customary in other parts of the world. As soon as the Christmas holidays had arrived, work and care were universally thrown aside, and instead of devotional practices by which other countries commemorated the sacred occasion, England rang from one end to the other with mirth and joviality. Christmas cards were trolled in every street. Masquerades and plays took possession in houses and churches indifferently. A Lord of Misrule, whose reign lasted from All Halloween, till the day after the Feast of Pentecost, was elected in every noble household to preside over the sports and fooleries of the inmates, while each member prepared himself either to some strange character or to devise some new stroke of mirth. The towns on these occasions, the houses were dressed with branches of ivy and holly, the churches were converted into leafy tabernacles, and standards bedecked with evergreens were set up in the streets while the young of both sexes danced around them. So it was just a wonderful time. I think a lot has been lost on more modern-day people because we don't seem to do the things that they did back in those times. To deck your walls on Christmas Day, the Victorians were very passionate about the decoration of their homes, and they were just as anxious for their churches to be subtly decorated as well. While flowers were decorating the sanctuaries at Easter, the scarlet berries were hung there at Christmas time. Twine and ivy in your homes, holly and ivy, in your hallways and throughout your house, even in the poorest dwellings, they were welcomed the festive season with these types of decorations with the great cheer. Now, as we mentioned before, gifts were only limited to one per person. And gifts, as I said earlier, were not always under the tree, but on the tree. Now, a lot of homes, gifts weren't even given, but stockings were hung on the mantelpiece. And each child would hang their own stocking, generally not one commercially bought like we would see today where you go to the store and buy one that's all fancy and made up, but generally one that they would wear every day. Mm-hmm. So they were always trying to find the biggest stocking that they could find in their stocking drawer in order to hang up. And then these were filled by Santa Claus or St. Nick or Kris Kringle, depending on where you were, with fruits and nuts and things like that. Often the other single gift that they were going to receive that was placed on the tree or under the tree was a clothing item or something of that nature, or if they were lucky, maybe a toy. The Christmas tree, it was absolutely beautiful to the children's eyes, standing there with those blazing candles, gleaming lights, laden with such thick-hanging clusters of rich and varied fruit. Fruit, popcorn was often used to decorate the tree before they had the advantage of using glass ornaments or ornaments were made. Prince Albert is credited with the introduction of the tree, as we said earlier, and again, it became the centerpiece of the entire season. The birth of the Christmas tree actually is Egypt, and its origin dates from a period long before the Christmas era. The palm tree is known to put forth a shoot every month, and a spray of this tree with 12 shoots on it was used in Egypt at the time of the winter solstice as a symbol of the year completed. The palm tree spray of Egypt on reaching Italy became a branch of another tree. The tip of the fir was found more suitable because of its conical shape, and it was decorated with burning tapers, lit to honor that of Saturn, and then celebrated from the 17th to the 21st of December, the period of the actual winter solstice. Christmas music makers, not all carol singers were welcome. On the first night of the Christmas holidays, the voices of carol singers floated in the night air, and if they were lucky, they were welcomed indoors for a glass of punch and a mince pie. If not, they would be shooed away from the front door. Mm. There's another aspect of the streets of London at Christmas which requires notice, more especially as this year is painfully prominent, the carol singers. So, you know, we're not going to see too many people going around caroling these days, but I know having lived in small villages and in small towns during my lifetime, oftentimes many churches in the area would have carolers going from door to door. And again, this was very, very popular during the Victorian era. And it was oftentimes a way for people to visit people that they didn't normally see. So people would often, during the Victorian era, would invite those folks in to have a little cup of cheer, as the song says. Who seemed to look upon themselves as privileged for the sake of the old familiar chant which they musically or unmusically pour into our ears, and who of all ages and of both sexes swarm in every street, in numbers of which an accurate estimate would convey. Somewhat alarming because of the poverty that was going on in London at the time. There was great poverty during this time. For a few weeks before Christmas, the streets of the 19th century began to assume a very new aspect. It became a musical city. People were out. The streets were busy. People were looking at the decorations, at the holidays, greeting friends that they haven't seen for quite some time. Christmas Eve in Victorian times was a day for arrivals. Those who were going to spend Christmas with their friends or relatives traveled by train or coach. The coach would be crowded both inside and out with passengers who were on their way to homes of relations or friends to eat the Christmas dinner. Others were returning home for the holidays and promising themselves a world of enjoyment. It was a time of families to be reunited and to enjoy themselves to the full, besides the Yule log's Christmas glow. We didn't talk about the Yule log, but the Yule log was what was cut and brought in to burn in the fireplaces of the Victorians. Through the deep, still night speed of the rapid trains from the factories of Manchester, the looms of bread from the farmyards of Norfolk and Essex, from the milk-abounding pastures of Devonshire, right onto the mighty babel of the modern world, where they discourage their wonderful burden, no long laboring and trolling through snowdrifts, no spurring of jaded steeds, no lumbering heavily in ponderous vehicles over half-formed roads, but swiftly, certainly, home onward bound, 30 or 40 miles an hour by that last great steam. And so men reached their homes at Christmas years and years ago. Now, I do want to recommend for people that aren't familiar with a gentleman by the name of William Sidney Porter, mm-hmm. commonly known as O. Henry, I recommend the reading of The Gift of the Magi to really receive the true meaning of Christmas. And this was written December the 10th of 1905. William Sidney Porter, O. Henry, was a very prolific writer. I think we've all read some of O. Henry's over the years. But in The Gift of the Magi, if you're not familiar with the story, it's a story of a husband and wife living in poor times at the turn of the century, not having much money and unable to really buy each other a Christmas present or a gift, decide to sell their most prized possession in order to buy each other a gift. And unbeknown to each other, one didn't know that the other was doing this, and I'm just paraphrasing this story, mm-hmm. but it's well worth reading. The husband had a gold watch that was a family, or had a watch fob, had a watch, and he didn't have a watch fob. The gold watch was a family heirloom, but he had no fob. His wife, on the other hand, had beautiful long hair, but she had no hair combs. So unbeknownst to either one, the husband decided to buy hair combs for his beautiful wife's hair, and she decided to buy a watch fob for his beautiful watch. She had to sell her hair in order to get the money to buy the watch fob, and he had to sell his watch to get the money to buy the combs for her hair. In the end, the true meaning of Christmas, celebrating each other and doing what we can for those among us. I want to read a poem, The Light Before Christmas.
We are at about 4 minutes, so you know where we are, Fred.
Okay, great. And just a quick reminder to folks that that grew up in the area of the Ideal magazines. I enjoy Ideal magazines. They're an absolute beautiful publication. I don't think they're published anymore, but they were very popular in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and I think even up until the early 70s. And a lot of the poems and things that I read around Christmas time come from Ideals that I've collected over the years, and you can still find them if you go to antique malls and places like that. On occasion, you can pick them up. Some were hardback, some were softback, but they are not just at Christmas time, but they're things that were published throughout all the holiday seasons, and they're just absolutely wonderful reading material. The poem I want to read now is called The Light Before Christmas, which appears in an issue the Illustrated from Christmas Edition, 1970. The light before Christmas is a sign which glows like a star in the sky, and people are lifted above dull routine as each day of December rolls by. And it shines in the faces of everyone as they meet in a crowded store. The same story prevails on every street, affecting the rich and the poor. It beams and it glistens with promise new, reminding us all at once again of the babe in a manger in Bethlehem who became the Savior of men. It shimmers in every candle flame in windows where trees are ablaze. There's radiance in the atmosphere as we listen to carols of praise. So people are lifted above dull routine as each day of Christmas rolls by. The light before Christmas is something divine which glows like a star in the sky. Mike, I want to wish all of your listeners a very, very Merry Christmas and a safe and Happy New Year.
And Merry Christmas to you and Terry as well. And thank you, Fred Malone, for being with us today to discuss the some of the things that came about during the Victorian era concerning Christmas. Just a little bit less than a minute, but was eggnog around that time?
Well, I didn't find it in any of my research, but I'm sure it probably was, and I couldn't find the actual ingredients to the wassail that was in the punch, too. There was a punch that was wassail, and I couldn't find any ingredients in that one either. But my guess is eggnog was probably prominent during that time, yeah.
It was. Yeah. Well, again, thank you, Fred, and again, Merry Christmas to you and to Terry.
Same to you and all the listeners.
We will talk to you again in the near future, and you've been listening to The Mike Wilson Show on WWGH. Be tuned in again next Monday afternoon at 5:15 to hear The Mike Wilson Show on WWGH.
WWGH Radio 107.1 FM, the place for the holiday season. For legendary actress and star of the hit TV series Hee Haw, Lulu Roman, reading 'Twas the Night.